Welcome on to a Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. I'm joined tonight, as I often am, by my co-host Danny LaRue. Danny, how are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. For those who aren't regular listeners yet, hopefully you will become so. But what we do here Sunday through Thursday nights, generally, we record. If there's a game, we'll talk about it, break it down in great detail. Unfortunately, we have not had the privilege of watching NBA basketball for almost a week now. So we've been doing some other stuff, previewing the off season, getting into some draft prospects, some of the news of the day. So pretty much anything that happens in the NBA world, we try to get to and get to it faster than some other people do, and hopefully in greater depth. So today, what we have on tap, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the situation with Dwayne Wade in Miami. Some additional reporting came out of there today on what the offer was for him. And we're going to talk about the LA Lakers offseason in a shameless grab for ratings, followed by talking about two draft prospects we didn't get a chance to go over yesterday, Justice Winslow and Tyus Jones, both out of Duke, and get to a few other news items as well. So, Danny, what happened today? There's some additional reporting out of Miami on the Wade situation.
Yeah, so Ethan Skolnick tweeted out that from what he had heard, that the offer that Miami made to Dwayne Wade was under $10 million a year, which is, it kind of ties in with what we were talking about yesterday, that they're putting themselves in a box with Dwayne Wade just with the structure of his contract.
Yeah, so for those who don't recall, didn't listen yesterday, Wade has a player option for $16 million this next year before he expires in the summer of 2016, and the Heat don't want to put too much long-term salary on the books with Wade because they are going to need to re-sign Hassan Whiteside, or they're going to need to try and get another free agent in the summer of 2016, and they also have to re-sign Goran Dragic and potentially Luol Deng if he opts out. So there's a lot of tension here between what Dwayne Wade gave up already for the team and then how having him on the books at a large amount could impact the luxury tax situation for owner Mickey Arison this next year, and then also impede their ability to get more free agents in the following year.
Yeah, and so they have this kind of dangerous concoction of a desire to actually keep their costs down, but also not trying to fight the perception that they're being cheap. And that was an issue partially with LeBron. There was talk about the Mike Miller amnesty as being an issue because that saved Mickey Arison a bunch of money. And so Miami is in a perilous spot because you want to make Dwayne Wade not only feel valued, but you also want to make that apparent throughout the league because you don't want to be considered one of those teams that isn't loyal or that doesn't treat their stars well.
Yeah, I thought that $10 million number, I mean, he is in control right now. I think that $10 million offer, there's some speculation on what the purpose of that is. One is basically to say, all right, you need to opt in for this $16 million. Otherwise, you know, we don't think you're worth that. We don't think you're going to get that on the open market. And so if you're going to opt out of that and you want to stay here long term, you got to take that $10 million. On the other hand, he already gave up $9 million for over these last 2 years to try and help the team. He justifiably would feel quite aggrieved that they're now trying to squeeze even more money out of him, basically this year, especially to just save the owner money. There's not really much other strategic purpose for it, at least this year. So I totally understand where he's coming from. I mean, were you shocked at how low that number was? I was.
I absolutely was. And especially when you consider his value to the team in the area, he's one of the few players in the modern NBA that is identifiable with a specific team. He's been there his entire career. And that is a really low number for a guy who's still, I mean, he's obviously past his athletic prime, but he's still a heavy contributor when he can get on the court. This isn't a situation where he's 38 or 39 and they're just being charitable. He's still a very good basketball player.
He is. I mean, he's not the greatest fit because he's probably not a dead set primary option at this point, and he doesn't space the floor very well, although he's gotten very good at cutting behind the defense when he was playing with LeBron. So, I still think he's probably worth, at least for this next year, worth more than $10 million a year, especially when you consider the amount of cap room the teams are going to have. But, you know, what is his market? Because you think about it, the teams that are going to have room and would want to and could pay him that much are all teams that are somewhat in a rebuilding mode at this point. And the teams that are real good already aren't going to want to try to rejigger everything to work him in as a secondary playmaker. So he may actually find that his market is a little more limited. But, you know, it is very interesting now to see the Heat potentially playing hardball a little bit. And what Ethan's reporting seemed to indicate was there's now been a little bit of a breakdown of trust, and that's going to need to be rebuilt because they're in an interesting situation now where they need to maintain the perception of loyalty after this guy and Udonis Haslem both opted out of their contracts to take less only a year ago.
Yeah, and Wade is also in a stickier spot because I don't see a ton of teams being willing to give a lot in terms of a sign-and-trade, and Miami could obviously play hardball like so many teams have in the recent past, because for certain teams, that's the only way that they can get access to him. And if you're talking about the teams that are so good that they would have a real benefit to having Dwayne Wade, a lot of them are in that grouping. And so that means that the pool of teams that are available to Wade, other than Miami, if he wanted to go that route, as you said, would be largely teams that are undesirable to him. I mean, there are some good teams that will have some space, but I'm not sure that he fits in exactly with what they want to do. Like, I don't think that the Spurs are going to be beating down Dwayne Wade's door, though I'm sure they would be happy to have him at the right price.
Yeah, but the right price, you know, is probably in the $5 million range, $7 million range. But, you know, if they're really only offering him $10 million, then it becomes a lot easier to say, all right, you know what, I'm going to take $7 and go somewhere else. Like, I'm sick of this, and hey, guess what? You're going to look really bad now that you lowballed me and I left. From the Heat perspective, it's really funny. It's like that Seinfeld episode where George finally has a job that he can talk about at NBC as a writer, and he feels like he can get girls. But unfortunately, he doesn't have the space to have a girl in his life because he's dating Susan, and Susan works for NBC. So if he dumps Susan, he loses the job that would enable him to get more girls. It's the same thing with the Heat. Now, if they, you know, one of the reasons they can't get the free agents is because they're going to have to pay Wade theoretically. But if they decide to dump Wade and they have the room, then all of a sudden they're not as attractive of a free agent destination.
Yeah, and that also, as you said, might be the reason why they're trying to maybe get him to opt in, because then you get a cleaner break, and that way, or whatever, you can get something, though that would force an issue of a cap hold, but then you don't get a lot of the negative ramifications going into 2016 of having your iconic player on another team.
Yeah, even that, though, is still kicking the can down the road, because number one, in 2016, you're not going to agree on what his market value is. And then because he already gave up $9 million, he's going to say, okay, here's what I think my market value is. Now pay me another $9 million over the course of this contract. So when you do that, his cap hold is going to be astronomical in 2016 and would prevent them from adding anybody else with their cap space, whether it's Whiteside or who they have to use cap space on. They can't go over the cap to re-sign him for the amount that he's going to want, or if you're going to try and bring in somebody else. So if you've got Wade now with a huge cap hold off of his $16 million, it would be 150% of that. You now have to agree with him very quickly on a new contract, because the cap hold stays on until you either agree with the new contract, get renounced, or you sign with another team. So they might be able to renounce him and then sign him with their cap space as well, but it's really going to be a very tricky dance, and one in which, you know, trust seems to have broken down a little bit.
While we're talking about easily identifiable players with a single team, you want to move on to the Lakers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. The Heat have kind of stressed this whole loyalty thing the whole time, and now they're really in a pickle because they asked the players to be loyal to them, the feeling that they're going to be repaid, and now it's going to be very difficult for them. I mean, the best basketball decision for them is to play hardball with Wade and get him to sign for as low of a salary as they can or move on from him. You know, I don't know if he's going to be essential to what they're doing going forward necessarily, especially with his lack of shooting ability. The Lakers are another team that just said, all right, we're going to be loyal to Kobe Bryant. We're going to show our loyalty. But, oh, hey, that's been a crippling 23.5, and now this year, $25 million on our salary cap that, you know, if they didn't have Kobe around, they could potentially bring in two max stars or two max stars and another guy. Now, though, they're not going to have a lot of room.
Yeah, and their flexibility is really, really limited because of Kobe's $25 million, and they have a series of other guys that they thought of, you know, as short-term contracts. Nick Young is getting about $5 million a year, but when you add that on top of 25, it gets a lot harder to make it, to make the cap work before everything explodes, and so that's why I think you and I are in the same boat that they should use this summer, given their constraints, to aim a little bit higher and take the consequences if that doesn't fall.
Yeah, and so let's set the scene here a little bit for the Lakers. They obviously have this year, they have, you know, enough room probably for a maximum contract, and we'll get to how you know, what the numbers are to how they get there. But then also you're considering really a two-year plan because they're going to want to get someone else in 2016-17. So they've got Kobe at $25 million. The cap next year is supposed to be one report said 67.4, another one said 67.1. We won't know exactly how much it'll be until the league does its calculations after the July moratorium. But Kobe's at $25 million, and this is people who are likely to be on the roster. Nick Young, $5.2 million, and has two more years on his contract after that with a player option in the 2017-2018 season. What a terrible contract that was.
Hey, he got more money for his engagement ring. Congratulations to him and his fiance.
But I mean, like, to pay, considering where the team was last year, number one, you're overpaying Nick Young for even what he was last year, even before he got injured. You also then consider that he is 29, so he's past his prime. So you're going to be paying him now for four more years into his age 33 season. And to do that, now you're compromising your cap space by $5 million each of the next 3 years. And for what? So you could have him last year and win, you know, 27 games instead of 22 or whatever it ended up being. That was the goal. It just a spectacular misvaluation in all possible respects with that contract. You know, it's only $5 million, but it just made no sense at the time and looks even worse now.
And they also could have used that money to give a little bit more to some intriguing low-level free agents to even give. And they didn't give anybody any of those deals. I call it the Hinkie special, which is that you sign a guy to a contract with longer non-guaranteed years so that if it works out, this is happening with a guy like Robert Covington, if it works out, you can do that. Even Jordan Clarkson, who had a very successful year, they're only getting a bargain with him for two seasons.
Yeah, he's going to be a free agent after this next year in 2016. Teams will be limited with what they can offer him in the first couple of years. But, you know, he's someone, if he has another breakout year, then he could really be an issue for them as well, as they're trying to bring in some big fish to join him next summer. So you've got Young at 5.2, Julius Randle under contract for another 3 years at 3.1. He was the number seven pick a year ago, missed all last year. Ryan Kelly at 1.7, and then you've got Robert Sacre, Tarek Black, Jordan Clarkson, and Jabari Brown all making less than $1 million. So all those guys are people you're going to want to keep. I think all of those guys have the potential to be a decent value when they're making so little. And then you've got a cap hold for this summer for the number two pick, which would be $4.2 million, and then another cap hold of $963,000 for the number 27 pick that they also have. So when you add all that up, and that's not including Jordan Hill, you wanted to talk about him, but when you add all that up, they would have about $22.5 million in room to offer a player this year.
Yeah, and so that gets into the sticky, I use that again, the complicated situation with Jordan Hill. And so a lot of times, especially earlier on in the NBA, teams use a team option on a player like Jordan Hill, which is actually what the Lakers did here. And with a team option, the team has to make a decision, just like a player option, before the year turns over. So that means basically before July starts. So he has a $9 million team option. So the Lakers have to make that decision by then. What other teams are doing now, and obviously players don't prefer this because it's less advantageous for them, is what's called a non-guaranteed year or partially guaranteed. And so what that means is the player is still movable after that point, and they can pick a spot in the future, whether it's July 15th or when rosters get due, or even, you know, later in the year, where some or all of the contract gets guaranteed. And so what that means is the player can be moved in trades. This is how Brendan Haywood's contract is going to work this summer. But so the Lakers have to make a decision on Jordan Hill now. They have to make a decision before on or before June 30th, and that also means that the only way they can use him in a trade to get somebody, if they wanted somebody, is to pick up his option and trade him, which means the other team has to want him at $9
million. Yeah, and so that's the key, is it's a hard yay or nay when there's a team option, and that's really better for the player to have a team option, to have his agent negotiate that, because either the team has to commit to you for the next year, or they let you loose into free agency. When it's non-guaranteed, then a lot depends on what your guarantee date is. If your guarantee date is late, then as a player, you run the risk of the team keeping you on, seeing if they can find someone else, and then maybe they can, and by that point, all the free agent dollars around the league have dried up. So it's very important that you'll see better players, and Hill was someone who had a little more leverage as a veteran and someone who, you know, theoretically was going to be a little better than just some guy off the street, get a good date on that. He already got the team option. Other guys, you know, you'll see August 1st, you'll see the start of the season, you'll see even into the season, and that really makes it difficult for a player. You're pretty much at the mercy of the team there. So that's the big difference between a non-guarantee and a team option when you're going into free agency, and Hill has a team option.
So what that means, as you said, is that they'll have to make a decision early, and and
that decision will be to not retain him.
I would assume so.
How much is that for?
$9 million. Another $9 million.
I mean, you have to imagine you can spend your $9 million in free agency a lot better than that, and especially when you consider that they have to decide before it all starts. They don't know what their other options are. I would much rather have $22.5 million in space and not have Jordan Hill than have Jordan Hill and only have about $13 million in space. So I think it's pretty much guaranteed that they will not exercise his team option. It would really surprise me if they did so.
And the way to think about this, the term that I've used is the Nene test, and that's, would another team consider this an asset? And I don't think a team, if they said, hey, you can have Jordan Hill for $9 million, I don't think another team would be like, hey, we'll even give you a second round pick for that. They'd say, hey, no, thank you.
Yeah, I think that's right. So Hill is really basically a center defensively and even offensively too, but just, you know, doesn't quite have the heft to really be a center, doesn't protect the basket, and, you know, even on offense, he's kind of limited to shooting a lot of mid-rangers. Really, you know, might be a guy who could be an okay third big for somebody, probably not a good team, frankly. You know, his teams have never really done that well when he's been on the court, despite the fact he's put up some good superficial points and rebounds at times in his career. So, you know, I think he's kind of more of a fourth big type on a good team, and $9 million for that is that's quite a lot. I mean, the reason that his contract was so high was that they gave him a short-term deal to retain him and see whether he would pan out. And that's fine. You know, it's good to give him a short-term deal. You overpay for that and see whether he's any good. And, you know, I think the answer was he's not really that good. And he's pretty much a fully formed now as a player. And so, all right, just move on from him and see what else he can get in free agency.
And the other reason why having Kobe's contract on the books stings the Lakers is that this is the year, because of how the cap is going to grow, that it would be nice to get good players on long-term deals. But when they have the space for basically one max player, you can't get that market advantage on as many guys. So that's why I support them narrowing their search to only the top players and trying to see if they can get one of them.
Yeah, and so who are some of those players, those top players, in your opinion? I mean, where do you kind of draw the line of like, all right, you know what, it's not worth giving this guy a maximum contract? Because, I mean, because you think, you know, this is a team that wants to win championships. If you're paying, you know, $20 million a year or high teens to certain players, you're not necessarily going to get there. So who would you be willing to pay a maximum salary to among these free agents, if you're the Lakers?
If we're talking about it in terms of years, which I assume that we are, my list is pretty narrow. I would say definitely Kevin Love, definitely LaMarcus Aldridge, definitely, well, probably, almost definitely DeAndre Jordan. And other than that, there are other guys who I would consider, but I'm not sure that I would give them their maximum. So that would be like Dragic and Paul Millsap.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you have to look at what the Lakers' timeline is too, and what are the alternatives. So for them, you might say, all right, go. If they had their draft pick next year, which they owe to the Sixers, it's top three protected. So tanking isn't really a great idea. Even if you finish with the worst record in the league, you're not guaranteed to keep it because you're only guaranteed to be in the top four. And obviously,
there's no way to guarantee for them that they'd be the worst record in the league, and that's not something the organization wants to do anyway. So if they had the draft pick, you could say, okay, we're going to try for the big fish. If we don't get them, we'll just kind of, you know, get some stop gaps and rebuild with another draft pick. And then once we have this great young talent on the team in 2016, we'll bring in, you know, two max guys, maybe even more than that. Hopefully that's the plan. Or you just continue to build with those draft picks. Not having that draft pick next year, now it's like, all right, what are we going to do? Are we going to just try and compete this year? Maybe. But then anybody who's worth their salt is going to have a demand a contract probably that's longer than a year. And so with that's the case, now you're impinging on that 2016-17 space, and you don't want to get an older guy who's, you know, 29 or 30 potentially, unless he's a real star, because then by the time your young guys get good, whoever this number two pick is going to be for them, either probably Okafor or Towns, or, you know, Clarkson or Julius Randle or whoever else you're going to have developing, those guys aren't going to be good by the time, and by the time they are good, someone you sign at 29 or 30 isn't going to be good anymore. So it's hard to see how you get there unless you get one of the real max guys. Then maybe, you know, I guess your idea for the 2015 offseason is just spend that space kind of on stop gaps and see where you can get, but have it all 1 year deals so that you can open up the space again in 2016. But that's probably not going to get you any to be any good in the 2015-16 season.
Yeah, and it's going to put them into that spot. There are also, their TV deal is something that apparently, you know, it gives them pressure to do well. And also, it's Kobe's last year under contract. It might not be his last year. There was some reporting out there that it definitely was. From what I've heard, that isn't necessarily true. And they have to balance this. And they have to, as you said, a lot of the best guys outside of that group aren't the guys that they would want to get on single year deals might not do it. Some of them might be betting on themselves, but most of the guys who bet on themselves are a tier above. And those are the guys that we're talking about is, of course, you offer those guys the max. And the other thing that will work for the Lakers that could go to their advantage.
Well, here, let me break in for a second.
Sure.
You said that the idea of betting on themselves, you know, maybe that's the one way that they might be able to do okay here, is to say to someone, all right, you know, I know the cap's going up in 2016. How about you come play here for a year, see if you like it. You know, we can give you a raise the next year of 20%. And, you know, we'll just give you a one-year contract with a second-year player option for you. And then, you know, that can preserve some of their flexibility for 2016 and get somebody in there. I mean, maybe they could convince someone to do that, but, you know, I don't. Why is someone like that going to waste, you know, they could do that a lot of different places. Why is someone like Kevin Love going to come there for a season that's basically, you know, you're guaranteed you're not going to get very far. Even if they get Love, he's going to be the only guy they get in. You add him to the rest of this roster and it's what, maybe the eighth seed if you're lucky. And, you know, it's not like they have some amazing coaching advantage either.
Yeah, it'll be a challenge for them to make the playoffs even with their best case scenario.
Yeah, so, and that's the hard thing about it, too. If you want to get someone in this year and it's advantageous to do so because the max salary is lower, you're basically asking someone to punt on, you know, a real superstar. You're asking them to punt on another year. LaMarcus Aldridge is going to want to do that. You know, he's 29 already. You know, why would he come to the Lakers instead of staying in Portland? He would have a much better chance of competing or going to San Antonio or even Dallas. And same thing with Love, someone who's in his prime. So if you're really going to use that space this year, now you're getting to where you're really going to have to overpay someone, and overpaying someone with this roster isn't going to get you much better or get you to the promised land either.
Oh, come on. You know you want to give Rondo 3 or 4 years on this team.
Well, and then there's another dynamic here, too, and that's the personal one in the Lakers management. And Jim Buss and Jeannie Buss have both said on a number of occasions that Jim has a pretty short time horizon in the next few years to get the Lakers back into championship contention. And he said that he will resign as the chief basketball decision maker if they don't get there. So now if he's really going to be held to that, and there's this kind of power struggle going on within the organization that he feels like they need to win, that could also be a recipe for taking some untoward risks on guys who may not necessarily be worth the money.
it's a huge danger for them. And I wrote a piece for the Sporting News a couple weeks ago, and the core concept of it was the Lakers' offseason is fraught with peril, and they have the opportunity for some great things, but if those wash out, they will tell a lot about the direction of their franchise by how they respond if they don't, and I don't expect them to hit on the big guns if they don't hit on those guys.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, someone would be enamored of the idea to play with whoever the number two pick is, maybe especially if it's Towns or Okafor. I don't know who players would consider to be better at this point. The other thing, too, is you might say, all right, well, what about some of the restricted free agents? For the reasons we've talked about, the fact that the max is so much lower now than it's going to be in the coming years, I highly anticipate that anyone who might be any good on a, even if you max them out, someone like Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green, Kawhi Leonard, all those guys are just going to get matched, and the Lakers would be loath to make that kind of an offer because they know it's going to get matched. You tie up your cap space for three critical days during the main decision-making period when you make that offer sheet. And so even someone like Chris Middleton, he might even get matched too if you max him out. And, you know, although I really like Middleton as a player and I think he's a good value overall, again, he's not necessarily a superstar type of player. So when you consider that, it's really going to be tough for them to get another star in there, and you just got to kind of hope that those rookies develop. If they had another draft pick coming next year, then maybe you could feel better about their future, but unfortunately they do not.
The one thing I'll add in on that part of it, though, is that I'm assuming that the major players will have already decided by the time the moratorium ends. And so to me, you are the most desirable destination, probably, for those restricted guys. So I would go to them if you strike out on Love and Aldridge and DeAndre, let's say it's those three. I would go to Jimmy Butler. I would go to Kawhi Leonard. I would go to Draymond Green and say, hey, we would love to offer you whatever contract you can get. And at that point, the 3 days isn't as devastating because you've already missed out. So moratorium.
It's getting matched anyway, though. So ultimately, I think, you know, it's kind of somewhat of a fool's errand to even bother with that. Given, you know, if the cap weren't going up the next year, maybe you could say that some of those teams might balk at matching. But it really, really would surprise me if any worthwhile free agent changes teams without getting, or a restricted free agent changes teams without getting massively, massively overpaid. And I think we can agree that those premium restricted free agents, the max is not an overpay for them.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to do on the Lakers, or do you want to go into the draft?
Yeah, well, let's talk about the 2016-17 season, too.
Sure.
They do have basically not much under contract for that offseason. They basically, let me take a look here. Yeah, if their draft picks sign for 120% of the rookie scale, they'll be at about $21 million committed for that offseason. The cap is projected at around $89 million for them. So the problem there, though, is now your max salaries go way up too, so you're getting less bang for your bucks. If you have an $89 million cap, someone even at the lowest max amount for 0 to 6 years experience, that's $21 million. $25 million for the next tier at 7 to 10 years experience, and then $29 million if you have 11 years experience or over. So now, really, even when you have that much room of almost $70 million, you know, that's space for two max free agents to be sure. But there's going to be so much money around the league, you know, it's hard to say you're going to get two guys to come in, and that also doesn't account for the fact that you might have signed someone in 2015. Who's going to carry over. So, I mean, they will have a lot of room. They will have a lot of flexibility. They could get that dream scenario in 2016, but it's going to be a little harder than you might think it is because the max salaries will also be higher in addition to the cap being higher.
And if Kobe decides to return, they will have to make a very quick decision on that because his cap hold would eat up a large portion of that. But I assume that wouldn't be a problem.
That's right. I mean, his cap hold would be for that maximum salary, $29 million. For the 11-plus year max. So, again, unless they decide to renounce him, which they could. I mean, if they'd be a cap team, they could just renounce him. That's probably what they'd do, actually, now that I think about it, they're going to use their cap space anyway. They're not going to be over the cap regardless of what they do. So they might as well just renounce him, and then they can re-sign him to whatever.
But, you know, there's still a leverage play and all that kind of – the fan base would be antsy and everything like that unless you already come to an agreement.
And for those who don't understand what renouncing means, it doesn't mean you can't re-sign him.
It just means that you lose the ability to go over the salary cap to re-sign him. But then that also takes his salary cap hold off the books. So you can now use that space for free agents, or you can use it on him again. You're just not allowed to go over the cap to re-sign him.
Exactly.
All right, so there's we do have some other news today. That was hopefully that was enough for, with the Lakers to get our ratings up a little bit. So a few things today. One is Carl Landry had another surgery, this time on a torn ligament in his right wrist, and he's going to be out 4 to 5 months, so that could get into next season. He's now 31, another really one of the worst contracts of the last 5 years was signing him by the Kings to a four-year, $26 or $27 million deal. And he's basically on the books at $6.5 million for the next 2 years. They've gotten just about nothing out of him these first couple of years because of injuries and the fact that he was also a short 29-year-old power forward who they brought in. Not really a great fit next to Cousins either. So that's been a disastrous signing, even at the time it was signed, and looks even worse now. He's, I think, would be a potential candidate for the stretch provision. And if they do that, his $13 million would be spread over 5 years rather than two. So that would enable them to open up a lot more salary cap space. And I think with them now looking like they may not really get much out of him on the floor, that is potentially an even more likely scenario for them. We'll see what happens there.
Yeah, and it's one of the rare contracts where a lot of people, including myself, thought it was a mistake at the time, and then it's turned out to be kind of what people expected. They already had Jason Thompson on a similar deal, and neither one of them was a particularly great fit, and so congratulations to Carl Landry for getting his money, but this is kind of how it turns out.
Yeah, we can also, this is now the third surgery that he's had. He had a torn hip flexor and a meniscus injury. So really hard to imagine he's going to be able to contribute at much more than like maybe a fourth big type of level going forward. Another one is Mario Chalmers had arthroscopic surgery to repair an inflamed plica. I believe that's how it's pronounced, PLICA. And that's, it was a short surgery. It only took 20 minutes according to the team account, but and something that may linger into next year, if he struggles, remember that he had this surgery that, was kind of news dumped in June during the finals. We'll see what happens with him. Hopefully he'll be all right. But he's older than you think he is. He's already 29. So he may be because he came out pretty late from college. So, again, didn't have the greatest season last year. We'll have to see. They really are counting on him for guard depth, both the one and the two, with guys like Dragic and Wade, who, are not necessarily the most durable guys in the world.
Yeah, and we also had some coaching news. Fred Hoiberg was announced as the new coach of the Chicago Bulls, which...
That came out of nowhere, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it came out of nowhere in, like...
No idea, we didn't even talk
in March.
About it on the show,
Yeah, we were really surprised in February or March or whenever that was first rumored. I mean, when was the last time that we saw a 50-win coach get fired last year, but this didn't happen in nearly the same way. And actually, that relates to the next piece of news, too.
So Hoiberg, hopefully we'll get a chance to get into his offense, and there are actually some really nice pieces on that I was hoping to get to today, but I didn't. So if we don't get to that, before free agency, definitely a great offseason topic to go through what his offense was like at Iowa State and how that might translate to the Bulls. A couple other news with assistants. Darren Erman hired in New Orleans off of Boston staff. Erman, you'll recall, is famous for being fired in Golden State for illegally recording coaching meetings when he was out of the room in the Palace Intrigue days under Mark Jackson. Kind of interesting that he now has had two jobs since Jackson got fired.
No comment.
But that said, you can say what it will about Jackson, but more importantly, I think, is that he is a really, really respected assistant. He was someone who first instituted the system of icing pick and rolls in Golden State, oversaw their great defensive improvement in the 2013 and into 2014 seasons. And Jackson deserves credit for that as well. And then also Boston, they were really good last year under him. They managed to be barely in the top half of the league,
defensively. And when you look at that roster, I mean, the bigs on that roster, Brandon Bass is probably their best defensive big. Tyler Zeller, Kelly Olynyk, Jared Solinger. I mean, do you think that that is not a league average front court defensively? And Ermin and Brad Stevens, you know, but I think Ermin was a big part of it, got them to defend at a very high level. So I think he's a great hire in New Orleans, a great compliment to Alvin Gentry's offensive wizardry. And, you know, he's exactly the kind of defensive assistant that you wanted to see them hire. And I think that bodes really well for what they're going to do next year.
I agree. And tying in with New Orleans, former New Orleans head coach Monty Williams is now going to be an assistant in Oklahoma City under Billy Donovan.
Yeah, I think that was reported by Mark Stein first. He supposedly has a good relationship with Kevin Durant from the Team USA days. You know, certainly a very, very experienced lead assistant for Billy Donovan and the type of guy that I think he needed both, you know, because Monty is really well liked by his players usually. I think he's someone who can relate to NBA guys in a way that, you know, Billy Donovan as a college coach may not necessarily be prepared to do yet. I mean, I think, you know, he's a great guy. I don't want to impugn him at all, but, you know, certainly dealing with college guys is a little different than the NBA. And also just, you know, his knowledge of the league. I think that's a really nice hire for Oklahoma City as well.
One other little nuance with the connection between Monty Williams and Kevin Durant is that Monty Williams was a successful player from the same geographic area that Kevin Durant grew up in, which is Northern Virginia and the D.C. area and Maryland. And Durant pointed to that also as one of the connections between the two of them.
Oh, good. So then they can both go home next year, right?
Yeah, once they have...
Just kidding, Thunder fans.
Once the Wizards hire Kevin Ollie next summer.
All right. So... Now let's get into a little bit of draft stuff. Try not to go quite as long as we did yesterday, but I looked at the two other Duke guys who are going to be the main guys in this draft, Justice Winslow and Tyus Jones. Winslow is someone I've been following since that 2013 Under-19 World Championship. He and Jahlil Okafor were the only guys who were rising high school seniors on that team. And Winslow, really the best thing about him to me is his floor game. He just plays so hard in a lot of these settings where he's going against less athletic guys. He just, you know, makes plays all over the court, whether it's on the offensive glass, you know, defensive rebounding, pushing the ball, getting steals, guarding out on the perimeter. His floor game is really, I think, probably the best of any wing prospect in this draft. And he's just someone who makes things happen that, you know, don't necessarily show up on the stat sheet, but Or if they do, you know, it's not in just the normal points scoring categories. He really just, like, imposes his will on the game physically with, you know, his great NBA body and above average athleticism for a wing guy.
And early on, it seemed like he was getting attention, and early on in his Duke career, for his defense. But his offensive game is underrated as well. He's not that, you know, that elite athlete, as you said, but he still is very capable on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he's not an elite athlete. Like, he's not someone who's going to dunk on people, but he definitely could finish alley-oops real nice. He can get out and dunk and transition, moves his feet really well defensively. So I think he's a solidly above average NBA athlete.
Sure.
You know, if he's not incredibly explosive, that's something that he might be able to improve as well. I mean, I think, you know, from an athleticism standpoint, he might be kind of similar to Jimmy Butler. That might be someone that I would compare him to, maybe not quite the 2-foot jump explosion that Butler has, but he's also really improved his jumping since he got in the league. So that might be someone you can think of just from a pure athleticism standpoint. And I think I really like Winslow in the sense that he has a low floor because he is athletic and he plays hard. And, he's an intelligent guy, great kid, and also someone who's really worked on his game, improved his skill level quite a bit since I first started watching him back in 2013.
Physically, from the measurements we got from the combine and everything else, he profiles as a pretty straight three, meaning small forward. Is that how you see him?
Yeah, I think he's someone who could ultimately play up in small lineups. A strong guy, certainly. You know, he's going to compete hard. I think he can avoid getting bullied. He played the four at Duke. As an aside, by the way, if you are a wing prospect with any kind of strength, go to Duke and play the four. I know it's kind of boring to play the four. You don't want to have to battle inside. But there have been so many guys now who have played that role at Duke and gotten drafted really highly and looked great going against the other team's fours with a spread floor and getting out in transition the way Duke does, whether it's Winslow, Luol Deng played that role for a while, Shane Battier played that role for a while. You know, even going back to Corey Maggette when he was a freshman, he played that role for a time. So that's a great idea if you're a wing prospect with any kind of strength. It's go to Duke, and they will make good use of you and make you look good for the NBA.
And that actually, with Winslow, ties in with something we talked about yesterday with Jahlil Okafor, and that's that from what I believe that Winslow had a higher percentage of defensive rebounds than Okafor did.
Yeah, he's a real good defensive rebounder. He also has improved his dribbling immensely. He can now dribble in transition. You know, when I saw him in 2013 and then, you know, at the Hoop Summit practices a year later and some of the Adidas events, he used to dribble pretty defensively. Now he actually attacks in transition. He's got some nice changes of direction. He's from Houston, and he's actually borrowed a lot of James Harden's moves where he'll, you know, he'll do that arm extend and go through guys' arms and get foul calls. So, you know, he's got a nice change of direction in Eurostep. You know, not quite the trickster and not quite the skill level that Harden has. You know, I don't see him being that type of a scorer in the league. But he's also really improved. A couple other things, and, you know, we'll get to the weaknesses in a second, but his jump shot, he's improved quite a bit as well. He shoots more of a set shot now from behind the three-point line, and he's very effective with his feet set. He shot 41% on three overall, but when he takes a dribble, he's totally ineffective, shot really badly on two-point jump shots, and he kind of shoots on the way down when he shoots an actual jump shot. So that's something for him to really work on. Also, finishing at the rim, a little bit of a weakness as well, because I think he doesn't have the biggest hands. He's not good at getting extension and finishing off the glass. You know, he finds himself having to have two hands on the ball trying to finish at the rim a lot, and it's a lot easier to do that. You see the best finishers in the NBA can, you know, extend the ball away from their body when they finish. That's not something that he is really able to do at this point, and maybe won't be able to. You know, not a ton of explosiveness off the dribble either. You know, there are plenty of times he would try and blow by college power forwards and wouldn't quite be able to get it done if he wasn't in transition. But I really like his footwork a lot, and he's got some great shot fakes and jab steps. So the way he has worked on his game is very, very encouraging for the future. Really high character kid. So, you know, I think talking about him as a kind of mid-lottery pick, maybe in a little bit higher, totally makes sense to me.
And one other thing I'll add is that friend of the show, Kevin Pelton, has talked about before how you can translate three-point shooting in the pros. One of the useful things you can use is free-throw shooting in college, and that's a little bit of a concern because while he shot 41% from three, Justice Winslow only shot 64% from the line. So that's a little bit concerning, but to me, when I watch him, it feels like it could be corrected.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, he is only a freshman, but you know, you would like to see him have a better percentage from the line, especially because he had a rep as a non-shooter coming into college. So, you know, he did do some surgery on his set shot from outside the arc, which is encouraging. He also has a developing right hand as well. So another thing that he's really worked on and improved over the past year or two is finishing with his right hand. He's gotten a lot better at it. Not great at it yet, but good to see, especially from a lefty, because a lot of lefties just, you know, treat that thing as a useless appendage on the right side of their body when they're finishing at the rim. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest concern about him probably in terms of his potential floor is that the shooting isn't necessarily real. A college season doesn't provide that much of a sample size, especially if it's only one and it's your freshman year.
Do you want to move on to Tyus Jones?
Indeed, I do. So Tyus Jones was the number one point guard recruit going into last year. Good friends with Okafor and Winslow going in. And the big knock on him, which we can get out of the way early, is he's not really considered to have the greatest size or athleticism for, you know, an NBA point guard. And I think that certainly limits what his ceiling is. But from a skill level standpoint, there's a lot to like here.
Yeah, and especially as a freshman, you see some things from him. He's somebody who I liked the limited amount I got to see from high school and really liked in college because his skill level for somebody that young is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the number one thing that sticks out about him is he makes a lot of value-added passes. And when I say that, I mean, you
You know, it's not, all right, this guy's open on the wing, I'm just going to throw it to him one pass away, or I'm going to drive and then dump it off to the big, you know, the kind of pass that you think anyone could make. Like, they talk a lot in the NFL about the quarterbacks who throw guys open, and Tyus Jones does that in a basketball sense. You know, great passes in transition, hit aheads to bigs running the lane. You know, he'll throw it ahead to guys on the wing in a nice way. Great at finding shooters on the opposite side of the floor in the pick and roll. You know, great passes to the roll man as well. So really can make all the passes very nicely. That's his number one skill, is his passing ability. You know, and also just a really smart player in just about all respects.
And when you talk about skill level, something that doesn't always coincide, but definitely does in his case, is both getting to the line and making free throws, because he shot almost 89% from the line his only year at Duke.
Yeah, that's really very encouraging as well for his jump shot. He was someone who's not, you know, when I saw him at last year's Hoop Summit, didn't take a lot of jump shots, didn't look that comfortable unless he was just left wide open. That changed this year. He was up to 38%, I believe, on three-pointers. And, you know, again, another guy who improved a lot. Doesn't look like the most natural shooter. He kind of shoots it like Shabazz Napier a lot of times, where like his right leg will kick out. And he's not that great going to his left shooting a jump shot either. Much better going to his right when you think about, you know, kicking that leg out. That makes it easier to go right with that. But I think he is improving from beyond the arc. And, you know, when teams would go under on him, he would make them pay. And he also, you know, a guy who gets at the rim, not the greatest finisher at the rim due to his physical limitations. You know, he's about average height, you know, 6'1 or so, but he does at least have a 6'5 wingspan. He's grown a little bit there in the last year or so since he was measured in earlier settings. So that's encouraging for his defense. But, you know, he doesn't get to the rim right at the rim a ton, but he does get fouled a lot. He does the Lou Williams where, you know, he'll feel contact as he starts to drive on the perimeter, and then he'll just put up a shot and the ref just has to call the foul, even though it's a cheap play. He'll do that a lot. So I think, you know, he had a 50% free throw rate, which when you consider, you know, there's more fouls in college, obviously, but when you consider his stature and what his game is like, that's pretty good. And he's getting a lot of those with intelligence.
Yeah. And for me, the question with him and with a lot of point guards is, can he punish the defense and can he force them to stress and to freak out? And I'm not completely sold on him in that, though I do like him as a player a lot.
Yeah, and I think, you know, his ability to finish at the rim is going to be key there. Is he going to make guys respect him so that he can open up his passes, you know, both from a shooting perspective on his jump shot? He does have a nice floater game, but, you know, you can only be so efficient on those type of shots. Certainly a little concerning that I think he's not going to be a great finisher at the basket. He only shot 55% at the rim in college. He is another guy who doesn't really get much extension, not a great leaper off of 1 foot, doesn't have a great left hand either, although he's working on that. And, you know, a lot of times he'll kind of slow down and try and go off of 2 feet instead of exploding off of 1 foot. And, you know, he's got to have two hands on the ball when he tries to finish it. So, I'm skeptical that he will be a great NBA finisher. I think that's what could keep him from ever being an elite player and, you know, keep him out of the top 10 in the draft. But the statistical translations do really like him. He's a heady player, another winner, makes winning plays, great anticipation. And especially if he can get his jump shot up to where he's a solid, you know, close to 40% on three-pointers from the NBA arc, I think he's someone who could be a solid starter in this league. And to say that, considering some of the point guards that we have, that's no slight whatsoever.
And something to consider with guys like Tyus, that who I like a pretty solid amount, are that any team really needs 48 minutes of a primary ball handler. And so even if, let's say, he falls down a little bit from that, you know, league average starter or a little bit below that, he's still an incredibly useful player to have on your team. And that's why if he falls a little bit out of the lottery, you should be looking at him, because your team is going to need a guy who spells your starter at the very worst and who can grow into that role. On a rookie contract, you get 4 years of this guy at a really cheap value if they're out of the lottery. So he's a guy who can provide that usefulness to a team even if he's not starting.
Yeah, I think he potentially could contribute early in his career as a backup, because I think he's someone who's not going to screw up very often. He had a really low turnover rate at Duke and someone who's just a very, very intelligent player. I mean, he's someone that you really want to like a lot, but you have to kind of, you know, slowly roll a little bit because of his lack of great physical attributes. But I'm also emboldened a little bit by the fact that most of the statistical translations seem to really like him, and he's a really young guy. So I think that especially if he can get his shooting up to pretty good levels, and to give an idea of kind of where he's at from an athletic standpoint, I'd put him maybe a tier below someone like Jeff Teague. He doesn't have that kind of quickness, you know, those kind of great Euro steps to finish. He's really not someone who's going to dunk it at all, even on a fast break when he's wide open. So he definitely is not very athletic and not very long. But, you know, he's got decent quickness. I don't think he's someone who's going to be embarrassed from a quickness standpoint, athleticism standpoint at the NBA level, but he's not going to be above average either.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Anything else you want to talk about with Tyus?
No, I think that's about it. That'll put a bow on it for today. Hopefully we're doing a good job still finding stuff to talk about in this dead period. We'll do a little bit more finals preview tomorrow night for everyone. And then we'll finally have some basketball on Thursday. We're looking forward to that. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please follow us on Twitter. Danny is Danny LaRue, LeRoux. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. You can go on RealGM and find the link to subscribe on iTunes or XML for your favorite podcast player. Actually, I will do a recommendation today, and that is for a podcast player, Dogcatcher is a great podcast player. And the reason why, it costs like $3 on the App Store, but consider how much time you've wasted listening to these podcasts already. It's worth $3 to make that experience better. And the thing that's really awesome about it is you can listen at up to 2x speed. And so I listen to all my podcasts on 1.4 speed. And so now you can listen to, you know, almost 33% more podcasts. And it doesn't sound like a record playing super fast or anything. It still sounds pretty good. So that would be my recommendation for today. Anything come to mind that we missed, Danny?
No, I think we're pretty much in it. I actually rewatched the Game 5 of the Warriors and Rockets today, and it was interesting to think about it in the context of the series that's coming up, because they did such a good job later on in the series of handling Harden, and I'm thrilled to see. I love 7-game series because you get to see the adjustments, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. But it got me amped up for Thursday.
Yeah, and actually something to plug to from a preview standpoint, Danny and I both contributed to a roundtable on the Warriors site previewing the finals, answering some questions from our friend Brian Witt, who works for the Warriors. So check that one out in the interim, and we'll give you all another podcast tomorrow night. Thanks for listening.